Ulafali, Professor of Philosophy at Easton SC State University. My guest this morning is Barry Lynn, Executive Director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. And our topic today is, what role, if any, should religion play in public schools? Barry, glad to have you in the show.
Well, it's nice to chat with you.
Thank you. Let's begin by discussing an issue that gets, whenever people think about the issue of religion in schools, it may be the first to come up, and that's the question of prayer. What role, if any, can or should prayer have in the public schools? Is it okay, in your view, to start the day with prayer, to have prayer at graduation, sporting events, etc.?
Frankly, I don't believe the government has any role in promoting or setting aside a time, a place, or discussing the manner or content of prayer with students. I think the Supreme Court of the United States was right in 1962 and 1963 when it said that it was a violation of our fundamental belief in separation of church and state for states to compose prayers or select prayers or have children on a regular basis stand up at a particular time of day and pray. Now, that's not to say that prayer isn't occurring in America's public schools. It is. It's just not government-sponsored prayer. There are something like 10,000 Bible clubs meeting before and after school in America's high schools, and they're praying in those clubs. No problem under our Constitution. And, of course, children are praying over lunch or if they need some kind of assistance or think they do over a test or over any other thing that happens during the school day. So there's lots of prayer, but government shouldn't be in the business of policing it, scrutinizing it, or forcing people to listen to it at official events like a high school graduation or a football game. Those official parts of the school day and the school time should not be the time when some government official says, okay, folks, now's the time for prayer, and here's a popular student who's going to pray one.
Okay, now, you made the point about the Supreme Court decisions in 62, 63, concerning prayer in the public schools, mainly opening the day with prayer. Now, what is the legal situation, though, concerning prayer at sporting events and graduation exercises? That, at least legally, appears to be different.
Yes. The Supreme Court has said that at a high school graduation, you cannot have an outside member of the clergy come in and lead a prayer. That decision was made. It was surprising to some people because many so-called conservatives on the court also agreed that this was a violation of the principle of church-state separation. The issue that's still being resoundingly debated all over the country in courtrooms and everywhere else is, could students themselves initiate prayer, you know, take a vote and decide that they're going to be a prayer and it's going to be a Christian prayer because most of the graduates are Christians? I think that's a profoundly bad idea, and here's why. I don't believe that at these official events, like a graduation, a single child should be made to feel like a second-class citizen at his or her own graduation. For those of us who believe in prayer and in the power of prayer, prayer is not just speech. You know, it's not like a breakfast cereal commercial. What it is a powerful, participatory event between believers, only believers, and God, either thanking God for something or asking God to provide something. So to force a person to either participate in this kind of religious activity at graduation or, in the alternative, leave the auditorium or get off the football field and leave for a couple of minutes and then come back really does relegate some kids to second-class citizen status. I don't want to see that happen, not when there are hundreds, indeed thousands of churches around this country who have, for the children of their own denomination, baccalaureate services before the graduation exercise. That is the time to be religious. The time to be religious is not as an official part of the high school graduation ceremony. That's a time for the secular recognition that you've done a good job and it's time to go on with your life.
Okay. Actually, the answer to that question is at least moving on to the answer to the next question, which is a bit more abstract. I mean, you point out that in the Constitution says that there, or at least the way of understanding it, is a separation of church and state. Why is that a good provision to have? And we're not now asking a legal question whether it's there. We're asking, if you will, a moral question. Why is it a good thing to have separation of church and state?
Well, you know, I think the framers of our Constitution had it right back 207 years ago when they put this provision that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, very broad, not just can't have a national religion. This says you can't pass laws that even touch on the subject of religion, because they thought it would be best not just for government, not to have to make what are essentially theological judgments and make laws accordingly, but they thought it would be better for the churches, for the religious institutions themselves, not to either feel that they need to seek the benefit of government, the blessing of government, or any resources from government, that it would be stronger for governments and for religious institutions to keep a decent distance between them. Roger Williams, the only head of one of the colonies who was a genuine believer in religious liberty, referred to this as a hedge of separation that he said should be maintained between the wilderness of the world and the garden of the church. Jefferson, of course, made it a little harder. I guess he didn't garden as frequently. He called it a wall of separation. But whatever metaphor you use, it's important to remember that this does not demonstrate hostility to religion on the part of government. It just says that government should be benignly neutral. It should not promote atheism in the schools, and it shouldn't promote Christianity. It should just be silent on the issue in its official role and capacity.
Well, now, if they were right that the separation of church and state is a benefit not only to the state and to the citizens, but to the church, why is it that so many religious groups at least appear to want to change, want to eliminate the wall, tear down the wall, say the wall doesn't exist, redefine the wall, in some way change the understanding that you are describing today?
Well, there is a remarkable amount of religious America that does believe that the Supreme Court got it right and that there should not be any amendments to the Constitution to bring the government back into the prayer business. And they spoke recently quite loudly and clearly to the U.S. House of Representatives in defeating such a proposal. So the Episcopal Church and the Presbyterian Church, the United Church of Christ, in which I'm a minister, all of these organizations oppose tinkering with this wall of separation. A few organizations have fallen by the wayside, including some religious groups, but most of the drive to change this wall of separation with dynamite if necessary are not religious groups. They're a bunch of political hacks hiding behind stained glass windows, calling themselves the Christian Coalition or the pro-moral community. All of these ways to describe what are essentially political activists who would like to use religion for political gain. I think that the proof, as they sometimes say, is in the pudding. The pudding of religious liberty in this country is really sweet, it's tasty, it's got marshmallows in it. We have 2,000 religious groups in this country, millions of Americans who, right next door to them, are people who have chosen no spiritual path. We live in relative harmony. If we want to look and see what happens when government favor is sought by religion, then you look at Iran, then you look at Algeria, then you look at any place where fundamentalists have taken over not just the church but the state, and I think anybody that is reasonable would say we've got it better here, we've got a rich mosaic of religious diversity here, we don't want to change it. This is in fact the most religious nation in the Western world. We don't have any religion taxes like they do in Germany. We don't have an official church like they do in Norway. But if you go to a church service on a Saturday or Sunday in America, the pews are filled. If you go in some of those other countries' churches, the pews are empty. The heart of religious liberty lies literally in the heart of the people without any need to have government help them, and I'd use help with quotation marks attached.
Okay, and you think that if the wall were torn down or rebuilt or lowered, that it might actually lower spirituality
Oh, absolutely, because politicians love to play with prayer. They're always passing resolutions about how much they like religious things. Newt Gingrich, the Speaker of the House, although he says that he really doesn't go to church, but he still thinks religiously. I don't want to cheapen American religious and spiritual commitments, and I think we do that whenever we get the government involved in this. Not too long ago, the House of Representatives voted to support the Ten Commandments. Now, somehow, I don't believe that Moses has been waiting all these centuries for Congress to get around to saying, good job, Moses. I think most people would be just happy if the Congress obeyed the Ten Commandments and would like them to butt out of any help posting the Ten Commandments, promoting the Ten Commandments, endorsing the Ten Commandments, just live by them. And I do honestly believe that if we lower the separation of church and state wall, we will end up with more politicizing of religion, and that will not help American spirituality. It will not help us be good people, good Christians, good Jews, good Muslims, or anything else. It will just increasingly politicize the church.
Okay. I'd like to go on and explore some of the other ideas, but let me pause briefly for the benefit of anyone who may have tuned in late. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest today is Barry Lynn, Executive Director of the Americans United for Separation of Church and State. A moment ago in the answer to one of my questions, you said that the state should not advocate religion, but it also should not advocate atheism or secular humanism. Certainly one of the criticisms that a number of religious people have raised in the last few years is that we don't really have a wall between separation of church and state. What we have is an increasingly secular humanist state, which they describe as a form of religion. Perhaps one of the places this is seen most often is in the debate over the teaching of creationism and evolution in schools. Again, the sort of frequent argument is that in the schools, in science classrooms, a large number of people are creationists. Why aren't we allowed to discuss creationism in the schools? Why are we forced to listen to evolution, which they see as godless? So the assumption is, the criticism is, that in fact what the wall of separation is not so much to keep church and state separate, but to actually promote an anti-church. What do you say to that?
Well, it's certainly not being very successful, because church attendance is at least as high, in fact, in many places higher now than it was 50 years ago on a regular weekend basis right here in America. So I guess if the forces of secular humanism are out there doing this kind of work and damage, it hasn't been successful. The reason we don't have creation science taught in biology classes is very simple. It is a science, and we shouldn't teach things that aren't science in science classes. Creation science is a bogus idea. There is no scientific support for this essentially religious idea. Now, does that mean we can never say anything about the idea of divine intervention? And I say no, because in social studies classes, history, literature classes, students, and indeed, if properly applied, even teachers can bring up these issues of how did we get here and so on, and allow students to express their religious opinions. But let's make it very clear. Science is for the teaching of those ideas where one can critically examine the evidence and come up with a conclusion. You know, we're still redefining and redeveloping the so-called theory of evolution. Some people say, well, it's just a theory. Well, so's the theory of gravity. Not too long ago, a major development was occurred in science in understanding gravity. It's not just about apples falling on Newton's head. So it's a bogus argument. There's no secular humanist takeover of the public schools. If you go into public schools, and I encourage your listeners to do it, even if they don't have children there, you're not going to find teachers throwing condoms off of the rooftop of the high school into the playground of the elementary school below. You're not going to see them teaching you how to communicate with the dead. All of these are criticisms from the so-called religious right. What you're going to see are people from your own community, good, decent people, who are communicating commonly shared values, but without a proof text from the Bible, the Quran, or any other religious book. I'm glad that in my son's public school in the state of Virginia, they teach respect, including respect for the opinions of others, that they teach people to be honest. I want those values taught. I just don't need a religious citation to be used in the public schools. He gets those at home, he gets those in Sunday school, at his youth group at church, and that's where he ought to get that extra layer of argument, which is fundamentally a religious one. But again, students can bring up these issues in class. They can, where appropriate, discuss these issues in a social studies class or what have you from a religious perspective. No one should silence those students. No one should censor those students. But we don't want to teach science as bogus science, or the next thing you know, people say, you know, astronomy, why don't we teach astrology also? We don't teach pseudoscience to America's kids and allow them then to compete with children around the rest of the world where they don't have this silly argument about whether evolution should be taught in America's schools.
Okay. All right, let's move on to a slightly different issue, the study of the Bible. When I went to school, we began every day with a prayer. We also had a Bible reading. What's your view on the reading of Bible in public schools, or the reading of other religious texts?
Well, certainly reading other religious texts or reading the Bible is certainly permissible, and in fact, in some schools for 30 years, they've been having courses in, for example, the Bible as literature, and they're good courses. Now, I say that with one caveat. There are some very conservative parents who object to any kind of objective study of the Bible. They view the Bible, and I have every right to believe this, as inspired by God. Every word is true. There are no ifs, ands, or buts, or criticism, literary criticism needed. So there, we have to be careful when we teach either comparative religions or the Bible as literature to recognize that some people see this as a holy scripture and that that's the only way it ought to be taught, and that you can't do in a public school. I think sensitive and well-trained teachers, however, can teach Bible as literature. Certainly we need to talk about religious allusions in literature. How can you read Faulkner and not know anything about the Bible? How can you read Shakespeare and not understand that there are all kinds of allusions to biblical references in it? That's certainly permissible. The role of religion in American and world history should also be taught, and the books, the school books, are doing a much better job doing that. The one thing I object to is what's going on in Florida right now, which is teaching the Bible as history. The truth of the matter is most Bible scholars would say, look, the Bible is not history. It is two salvation stories of two people. If you believe in the Old and the New Testament, it's about two communities of faith and how they understand God. But to literally say this is historically accurate is simply not a proposition that can be taught in America's public schools. If you want to teach Bible as history, you're going to have to do it in a religious school or in a church, a synagogue, a temple, a mosque, where many, many Americans worship, but not in a public school. If you're going to talk about it objectively, subject it to the same critical thinking that we do for every other class, you know, and every other issue in social studies and history, fine. If you want to use it as a surrogate for what ought to happen in a Sabbath school or a Sunday school, then you are on the wrong constitutional wavelength thinking you can do that in a public school.
Now, I understand the distinction. I understand being able to say that you could read the Bible as literature versus reading it as sacred text. The former you see as constitutionally legitimate, the latter as constitutionally illegitimate. But how likely is it, in fact, that in most school districts you can actually do that? I mean, you've got two worries. One worry you mentioned a moment ago, that perhaps the child who believes that the Bible is infallible, every word has to be taken literally, will not want to read his literature, and so requiring that student to take the course could violate the other part of the Freedom of Religion
Correct.
Amendment. But now let's imagine the other one, that the person teaching this class happens to be someone who is of that persuasion but has been asked to teach the course Bible as literature. Are they in fact likely to be able to do that in a way that does not, to use your language earlier, make some of the students feel like second-class citizens?
I'll tell you, it's a great question, and I wish the answer was it's easy to do it objectively. It's not. It requires training, and virtually no one is getting that kind of training today. How do you teach this fairly, honestly, without allowing your own biases? And I don't mean that in a negative sense, but we're more familiar in this country, as an average teacher, for example, with Christianity. And maybe we know a little about Judaism. We've been to a bar mitzvah. You know, we think we know something. But we don't know much about Islam. We don't know anything about Buddhism, Jainism. We don't know anything about a lot of other faiths that exist in this 2,000-plus religious community that we've got here in the United States. So unless we train teachers to do this right, and it's not being done very often today, it is a dangerous subject. It's dangerous either because we're going to end up reducing some students' religious beliefs to nothing, or we're going to end up subtly, as teachers, promoting our own religious convictions. So it's difficult. It's possible to do it. It's difficult. Every school system, though, needs to make a fundamental decision. You know, you've got a certain amount of time in the school day. Is it more important to teach Bible as literature or teach economics? And I think a lot of schools would say, let's opt for economics, and we're hoping that the parents of religiously motivated children are learning about their religion and others in their place of worship.
Okay, but the chance that a teacher might abuse their power in teaching such a course would not, in your view, provide a reason to prohibit it?
No, it wouldn't, because I think that you have to look at these on a case-by-case basis. You have to look at and assume that... See, I'm willing to make the same assumption about teachers in regard to this as I do in general. They're not out to corrupt my children. They're not out in general to persuade them to be Republicans, Democrats, Socialists, Libertarians, or Episcopalians or Baptists. That if they're doing their job, they're trying to be open and honest. Where appropriate, they may be sharing their own views. Where not appropriate, they're simply trying to let kids learn how to think about the issues that are going to matter as they grow up and as they get out and become voters themselves. So I give teachers a lot more credit than some of the foes of public education on the religious right do. I don't applaud the idea of doing away with the Department of Education. In fact, I think the Department of Education did a marvelous thing recently by sending once again to every school system in this country a list of guidelines of what kinds of religious activities can actually occur in America's public schools without violating anyone's constitutional rights. The President of the United States recently gave a radio address on his Saturday morning radio address on the subject of religion in schools. He said, you know, schools should not be and are not religion-free zones, but there are certain ways in which religion can be practiced and some ways which violate the rights of others. It's very clear if you read the Department of Education's guidelines on the matter that there's a dizzying level of religious freedom in this country. Not only those Bible clubs before and after school, but children can pray quietly without disrupting others at many times during the school day. Indeed, children, unless there's a dress code that prohibits them from wearing any t-shirts, so they can wear a t-shirt that says Jesus Saves, in the same way that they can have one for their favorite heavy metal rock band. They can express religious ideas as parts of their assignments, as long as those are germane to the assignment that's been granted. They can go to a fellow student in the hallway and say, would you like to come to church with me? In the same way that they could also say, hey, would you like to go to the movies with me on a date? You know, this kind of common sense but significant religious activity is occurring all over America. We've got that freedom right now under the Constitution we have, and I think a lot of us say the balance has been struck properly, and it is a good thing for religion and a good thing for public education that we are at the line where it is today. We don't need to move it. We don't need to erase it. We just need to respect it.
Okay. Let's move to just briefly touch on an issue that's very hot, the issue of vouchers. I'm going to be doing a couple of the shows on the topic, but I know it's an issue that interests you considerably, and it interests you primarily because of the question of the separation of church and state. Slightly different angle, perhaps, than
sure.
Some people might say. So What do you have to say about the Wisconsin Supreme Court decision?
I'll tell you, I was a teacher in a Catholic school in Boston for a number of years. It was a religious school run by the Sisters of Notre Dame, a religious teaching order of the Roman Catholic Church. It was religious from the time that students got there in the morning until the time they left in the afternoon. That's perfectly fine. As a person of religious conviction myself, although not a Catholic, I have absolutely no problem teaching in such an environment. They did not get one penny from the state or the federal government or the city of Boston to run that school, and they ran it religiously. If we do what the Wisconsin Supreme Court will now at least temporarily permit to occur in Wisconsin, we'll find tax dollars flowing into these religious schools. Now, we've deposed hundreds of people over the years in this organization who run religious schools. We ask them, what's the purpose of your school? You know, nobody ever says, well, the purpose of our religious school is to have fewer students in the classroom, a better student-teacher ratio. That's not what they say. They say the primary mission of the St. Anne's Church is to communicate the same thing as the St. Anne's School, belief in Jesus, or a strong support for the Roman Catholic position, or the position of Muhammad in our lives. They are honest. They tell us what they want to do with those religious schools, and that is be religious. But we can't ask all of America's taxpayers to support the religious ministries and missions of some who happen to run public school, or excuse me, happen to run private schools. So this is the same way that, in the same way that we don't allow money to now flow from the Congress to every church, for example, we shouldn't allow money to go from the taxpayers' pockets into the religious ministries and missions of those same churches, and those include private religious parochial schools. To me, it's a no-brainer. If the United States Supreme Court, I think, within the next few years will have a chance to decide, are vouchers that essentially distribute tax dollars to religious schools a violation of the principle of church-state separation? The Wisconsin Supreme Court said yes. I think the U.S. Said no, but the U.S. Supreme Court will say yes. Clearly, this is funding religious ministries, and it has no place in our constitutional system. So I hope the Supreme Court takes this case from Wisconsin. We're certainly going to try to get them to do it, and ends this futile, useless debate over vouchers, an unworkable scheme in the first place. I mean, it doesn't really help to improve test scores when the kids get these vouchers. All it does is help private religious schools be subsidized by picking the pockets of every taxpayer, and that is not something that Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, or George Washington would have been very happy to see occur in America.
Okay, we've got 1 minute left. Could you sort of give a summary of what you take the answer to the question to be? What place, if any, does religion have in the public schools?
Religion has every place that students want it to be. God, in the view of those of us who are God believers, cannot be expelled from the public schools by government action or by actions of the courts. Religion resides primarily in the hearts and soul of believers, and it's going to be there whether you're in or out of a public school.
All right, thank you very much for appearing in the show.
Thank you. It's been a great time.
I've been speaking today with Barry Lynn, Executive Director of Americans United for the Separation of Church and State. This is Eula Follett, Fridays and Issues. Good day.